Despite the asymmetric beginnings of Russia's full-scale invasion, Ukraine's institutional resilience and steady support from its allies have brought a new balance to the battlefield. Both nations now operate under distinct forms of military Keynesianism, shaped by regime type and economic dependencies on both sides. In this episode, we unpack how the war is transforming state capacity, fueling economic strain, and redefining the very path to peace, not through military victory, but through the shifting alliances and domestic pressures. Stay with us as we examine a war where economics may determine the endgame more than firepower.
Your country is in big trouble.
I know.
You're not winning.
I know.
You're not winning this. You have to be thankful. You don't have the cards.
I'm thankful.
You're buried there. Your people are dying.
I can tell you.
You're running low on soldiers.
Don't,
listen.
Welcome to this special episode of the Conflict Zone podcast from the London School of Economics with me, Malik Barat. Together, we explore the changing nature of global conflict in the 21st century by taking a closer look at the causes and drivers of war and intractable violence. Today with me discussing the latest research is Dr. Luke Cooper, the director of PeaceRep's Ukraine program and a fellow at the LSE's Conflict and Civicness Research Group. Hi, Luke. It's great to have you. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Well, it's definitely been an extraordinary week in terms of the developments in the Russia and Ukraine war. So excited to speak about the insights from you on this topic today.
Yeah, absolutely. Really pleased to be having this discussion.
Hard to believe now, Luke, but we are 3 years into the largest battlefield conflict on European soil since the Second World War. And at this somber milestone, words like peace and negotiations are starting to make rounds again, though let's be honest, they've become more buzzword than breakthrough. One of the loudest voices calling for an end to the war has been coming from Washington, which has been a staunch ally for Kyiv since the outbreak of the full-scale invasion. You might remember former President Trump boldly claiming he could end the war in just 24 hours. Well, that hasn't exactly happened. So where do things actually stand? Over the last few months, Russian and Ukrainian delegations met twice in Istanbul, their first official meeting since March 2022. Now, one tangible outcome from this was a major prisoners of war exchange between the two sides. Around 1,000 people swapped in a very rare moment of cooperation. But beyond that, Ukraine has largely dismissed these talks as little more than theatrical. It accuses Moscow of sending a low-level delegation, while also continuing to pursue the same maximalist demands as in 2022. And in response, the Kremlin has insisted on addressing the so-called root causes of the conflict, rather than opt in for the unconditional ceasefire put on the table by Ukraine and supported by its partners in the West. On the ground, things only seem to be escalating. Kyiv, Ukraine's capital and most populous city, has faced record-breaking missile and drone attacks. President Trump has notably weighed in on these attacks after a noticeable delay, calling Russia's President Vladimir Putin crazy, but at the same time continuing to criticize both sides. Ukraine, however, has surprised its critics once again by launching an undercover operation it calls Spiderweb. So this featured smuggling over 100 of drones inside sheds on the back of trucks into Russia, unleashing them near the perimeter of 4 air bases, and according to the Ukrainian side, destroying 34% of Russia's nuclear-capable cruise missile carriers. So Luke, based on your analysis since the start of the full-scale invasion and up to now, do you share President Trump's assessment that Ukraine does not hold the cards?
Well, I think what we've seen in the last 24 hours at the time of recording, I know it will go out a little later, that you've referred to the sort of Operation Spiderweb, this like remarkable act of ingenuity is revealing, of course, for some of the cards that Ukraine does indeed hold in the war and in the negotiations. And I think maybe it's worth just stepping back for a moment and thinking about what this reveals about Trump's view of the world, this formulation, you know, the idea that geopolitics is just a kind of a game of poker, if you will, where one side, if you have good cards, win the game. And if the other side, you know, you have rotten cards, then you've got no way of winning the game. Is acting for Trump as a kind of metaphor for how he views international politics, where there are some sides or some states that are very strong, that have high amounts of economic resources and military capacity, and there are some states that don't have those things and therefore in a weaker position, and the weaker do not have any choice but to accept the demands and diktats of the stronger, even when that extends to their own domestic affairs and security arrangements. So that formulation and that moment in the argument, the famous Oval Office, infamous perhaps row between President Zelensky and President Trump, it is totemic of something broader here. And I think what you can refer to it on the American side is a conception of international politics, which is basically about great powers dominating the weak and dominating the rest. And for Trump, there are three constituent great powers. One is Russia, one is China, and one is the United States. And then there's a series of fragmented and muddled states in Europe that Trump considers an irritant, if you like, but doesn't really afford them the same kind of great power status. And I think it's no coincidence with that view of the world that Trump has also repeatedly throughout his political career, from the first term administration to the second, expressed admiration and lauded praise on authoritarian and dictatorial leaders within that context. He considers them clever, to be masters of politics, to be very smart guys and this kind of thing. So there's an interaction there between two levels. One, a kind of ideological authoritarianism and attractiveness to that kind of far-right politics, and the other, this connected view of the world as one of a series of great power contests over resources and territory. Now, in that context, I think it's worth asking, well, does Ukraine actually hold some cards here? And if we conclude that Ukraine does indeed have some cards, does indeed have power capacities, therefore, then I think it's revealing of some of the limits of great power politics more generally. Now, Ukraine today controls more Ukrainian territory than it did in March 2022 at the very outset of the war. A fifth of its territory is controlled, of course, by the Russian side. But Russia has not been successful militarily, despite massive resources, despite access to oil rents, to gas rents, to the mobilization of a much larger army, despite, of course, having nuclear weapons. It has not been able to mobilize that formal advantage in military capacity to impose a political outcome on the Ukrainian people. And part of the reason why it hasn't been able to do that is that Ukraine, of course, has other power capacities that it's been mobilizing. It's been mobilizing, I would argue, a kind of power of legitimacy that we could speak to, perhaps. The fact that Ukraine united on such a universal basis behind opposition and resistance to the Russian invasion has made it very difficult for Moscow to impose a military outcome and settlement on the Ukrainian people. And I think this may be more in general revealing of the limits that the use of force faces in the 21st century. We have countless examples now of failed military interventions, or military interventions where the military component of it went okay, like Iraq as a kind of military contest. Saddam Hussein was defeated, but then the politics was disastrous thereafter. And so just because you have formal capacities, high capacities in military power, doesn't make translating them into political goals based on the control of territory at all straightforward. And within this context, I think part of the argument and reasoning here is that Operation Spiderweb is also very revealing of the powers that Ukraine has, and indeed all states or armed actors in an asymmetric situation have, because it's used relatively low-cost technology, drones that are domestically produced on a very, very large scale through quite a sophisticated but nonetheless inexpensive or relatively inexpensive war economy that's produced a massive amount of this kit. That kit has then been able to destroy, through the ingenious mechanisms that you've referred to, subterfuge, unconventional war in effect, espionage, secrecy, etc., getting the weapons into Russia behind enemy lines, and has destroyed military equipment of far greater value than that which was actually used to make the attack. So there's a fundamental asymmetry there in the political economy, where something much cheaper has been able to destroy something much more expensive. And again, I think this is revealing of some of the fluidity of power in the 21st century and the limits on great power politics. And then I think the last thing I would say is that, I mean, Ukraine has not caved in these negotiations to the maximalist demands that Moscow has put forward. It's still there. It's fighting a war of attrition with an army of nearly 1 million soldiers with battle-hardened experience. Those soldiers are not going to retreat from positions that they are holding at the moment if there isn't a military need for them to do so. And that therefore means that, of course, Ukraine has a material capacity here, that it's holding cards in the negotiations. And I think in the last couple of days, you've seen that it's playing those cards really quite effectively.
Absolutely. And the world is seeing clearly now how this asymmetry in terms of military and other resources has pushed Ukraine to be more creative in its tactics. Now, an interesting number claimed by the Ukrainians is that the destruction of Russian aircraft in Operation Spiderweb resulted in approximately $7 billion in damage for the Russian side. Meanwhile, the drones, there were slightly over 100 used, cost each around $4,000. So this again brings us to a much more nuanced discussion about the true balance of power in the Russia-Ukraine war, as opposed to the great power politics lens you mention is used to interpret the conflict by state leaders like Trump.
Yes, totally. I mean, absolutely. I think, you know, those factors hit the nail on the head. I mean, the one thing I would add, though, the damage to the Russian side may well be greater. I mean, I look at the political economy of the war. I'm not a military weapons technology guy in any respect. But in terms of security specialists and military technologists I've been reading in the last 24 hours, I think some people certainly are making the argument that the costs to the Russian side may be greater than that numerical figure. And that's because Russia has struggled to build these planes in the post-Soviet era. They're very capital intensive. They require very sophisticated aerospace industries that have been marginalized and restricted in the post-Soviet period. So they've tended to prefer to refit existing Soviet stocks and upgrade them rather than building them afresh. And if that's correct, then of course, the damage to Russia's security capacity is actually greater than the $1 billion figure that you raised, right? It's potentially a numerically impossible to quantify number. It's like a qualitative blow to Russia's military capacity.
Exactly. And this begs the question of how we need to look at this situation from a historical perspective. Your research, it acknowledges the role wars and violent conflict play in constructing and deconstructing the very fabric of a modern nation state. And I think it's fair to say, especially in the current media environment, some of these processes remain under the radar or even invisible at times. Luke, what does the academic research tell us about the different, or perhaps not so different, trajectories of both Russia and Ukraine, historically and in the context of this ongoing war?
Yeah, so historical sociologists have always recognized, and this follows the work of Charles Tilly, who had the very nice, elegant formulation, war makes the state and the state makes war, and have always broadly recognized that there's a relationship between warfare and state building. And Tilly even goes as far to push the envelope on this argument and get us to really think about the process of historical state making in Europe from the 16th and 17th century onwards as perhaps reflecting a kind of bandit criminal enterprise to some degree, that the if we tell a story of liberalization, we're going to unnecessarily occlude actually the violence and tyrannical processes that marked European state formation across this period, that states were continually at war externally with their enemies overseas, but then internally had to increasingly centralize resources and harness them for those conflicts abroad. And that process created a centralization of resources around the modern state that required it to be independent to some degree of market forces. So Tilly invites us to think about this as a relationship between mechanisms of coercion and mechanisms of capital. Now, of course, the nuance here is that to have effective markets, then you have to have rule-based interchanges. So in the process of institutionalization, an autonomous state is necessary to create some kind of level playing field or rules or body of institutional law that can underpin expanding capital markets. So it's that relationship between centralization of state resources and market relations and the accumulation of capital that Tilly invites us to think about. Now, why is this of relevance to Russia and Ukraine's post-Soviet development? And I think we can think about the two sides as sharing, of course, that same experience of post-Soviet independence, of course, with very different ideological interpretations of that experience. Russia experienced it as a loss of empire, in effect. Ukraine, of course, experienced it as a liberation from empire. But both went through an economic transition from a very centrally planned economy where the capital was deliberately repressed, to one in the 1990s where the state completely lost its ability to regulate markets at all and resembled a kind of bandit-like economic order. Some of the literature describes this as the rise of the period of violent entrepreneurs, where those with access to the means of economic accumulation in this moment in the 1990s had to simultaneously build paramilitary organizations to protect their economic interests as the state really broke down. So what happens after this broadly is that in both cases, the state needs to retain or take back its autonomous organizing capacity. And what happens in the Russian case, in Putin's case, Putin comes in and disciplines the oligarchy and the violent entrepreneurs and recovers the state's capacity for autonomous organization, but in an extremely and increasingly autocratic form over time. So the story of Putinism is a story of greater kind of return of the former Soviet bureaucracy to power in a way, and then a move from oligarchy to autocracy over time. And Ukraine, the story is, of course, very different, and we could talk about some of those differences. But I think in the Russian case, this is a story of authoritarianization and growing autocracy that we can trace from the middle of the end of the 1990s and the rise of Putin through the 21st century up until the Russo-Ukrainian War. And of course, Putin was greatly assisted in being able to carry through that transformation by Russia's oil and gas rents. That really created the lubricant that allowed this whole system to forge.
Then a very straightforward question, but perhaps with a more complex answer. Does Putin's authoritarian grip over Russia, including its resources, give him more agency to mobilize revenue and continue this war indefinitely?
In state-building theory, the critical question is raising revenue. And of course, in the Russian case, the revenue came in the 21st century transition that we've talked about from oil and gas rents that allows the Russian regime to maintain very, very low taxation conditions on capital and on the wider private sector oligarchy. And not just low taxation systems, but a system of subsidy for the wider economy and wider elites from those oil and gas rents. You can think of this like a kind of lottery win where the Russian regime is distributing rents across the entire system, rents that it has by a pure contingency of geography, and has harnessed those to pay off this large parts of the elite. Now, in the war itself, I think we find that new distributional choices opposed. So on the one hand, the war necessarily strengthens the autocratic character of the system. And perhaps we could even see this as a movement from what we might call the neo-patrimonialism of the early Putin regime, where there's an autocratic patron, Putin, at the center, but a series of other interest groups and factions that are lobbying him for different positions and that are relatively ideologically eclectic, and where there's a blurring of politics and economics because of the system of rent that underpins the whole political order. Now, that's the case in the early Putin regime, but then we have this turn towards growing personalized dictatorship over time. And the war, of course, further centralizes that personal dictatorship to an even greater degree. Perhaps we can now look back, and maybe it was obvious at the time, at the Wagner Rebellion, and see this as a moment where that story of centralization became particularly apparent, when a paramilitary organization that had lived through patronage of the Russian state and the Putin regime, but had a semi-autonomous relationship to it, and that semi-autonomy was considered a virtue and part of its usefulness and utility for the Russian regime, that then becomes a problem the moment at which it politically challenges Putin. And that, of course, is unacceptable for Putin. And then you get this process of further centralization. And of course, Prigozhin's death at the hands of the regime, we assume, is a sharp illustration of this new kind of autocratic order that has taken hold in the course of the full-scale invasion.
Yes, it is absolutely crucial to understand the domestic politics in Russia in order to understand the current political economy there. But Luke, can you elaborate more on this dependency on fossil fuels and the consequences this has for the war economy more generally?
So oil and gas are the critical lubricants of the Russian war economy, and of the two, oil is much, much more important because it's a major generator of export revenue. Most gas is still consumed domestically within Russia, though gas is becoming more important as an export market for the regime. And that's to some degree due to supply and demand trends in the global market. So demand for oil is falling and demand for gas is stable or rising, and particularly liquefied natural gas is a growth market globally over the next 2 decades in the context of stagnating and falling demand for oil. at the moment, in terms of the generation of revenue, oil has been much more important for the regime. It benefited considerably from the massive oil price spike of 2022, and it gave it, in effect, a massive economic windfall to stabilize the economy and to spend on the war. At the same time, of course, Russia is under sanctions, and there have now been 17 different European sanctions packages attempted to target and restrict and raise the costs of production on the Russian side and cut off its access to international revenues. For example, financial sanctions makes it very difficult, impossible indeed, for Russia to borrow on international sovereign debt markets. And then that means, as a result of that, that Russia has to run a positive balance of payments surplus, so to be selling more on international markets than it's importing in order to fund its war economy. And so if it moved into negative balance of payments territory, it would force a major structural readjustment in the economy, a recession, and probably also a financial crisis. So oil in the last decade has been responsible for between 30 and 50% of government revenues. So when we're thinking about the Russian economy, we have to fundamentally recognize its petrostate and fossil fuel character. And hypothetically, if Russia was tomorrow unable to sell oil on international markets, then it would cause a significant economic crisis for the economy, and it would pose distributional challenges for its ability to continue to fund the war.
And the importance of energy rents in quite literally fueling the Russian war machine has been, of course, recognized in Europe. There is much to say about the 17 packages of EU sanctions against Russia that have been passed up to this day. But let's zero in on a very specific form of gas called the LNG, or liquefied natural gas. This is a focal point of Europe's decarbonization agenda, and Brussels has been actively pursuing deals with non-traditional partners like Azerbaijan, Algeria, and Qatar. However, Russia is also a major LNG producer. Now, the sanctions, as far as I understand, are aimed at preventing EU facilities from quote-unquote transshipping Russian LNG to third countries. But there seems to be little in the way of actual imports into the EU. Luke, is this potentially the next addiction problem for Europe?
Yeah, so there's lots of focus now, sort of intellectually and in the policy community, about liquefied natural gas. And this is because of the remarkable factoid that now more than 50% of Russian LNG is now going to European markets, which seems extraordinary given the fact that European states are mobilizing on the side of Ukraine, and all of this discussion that we had previously about breaking the addiction to Russian gas, all of the critical discussion of the German Nord Stream pipelines and this kind of thing. We've now got to a situation where LNG is predominantly going, in terms of Russian production, to European markets. Now, at the same time, LNG is still a relatively small proportion of Russian fossil fuel exports, so we shouldn't overplay it, but we shouldn't underplay it either. Now, there's also an important curiosity in the European approach to LNG, and this is a super complicated area where, you know, you really need to get a sanctions specialist on to talk you through some of the nitty-gritty. But in some terms of the top lines, EU's 14th sanctions package from June last year did make it legally more challenging to move Russian LNG through European ports and infrastructure, but it didn't wholly stop it. And this is a classic area where terminology is key and the legal terminology is central. So there's a really excellent Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. They're a think tank that's one of the premier sources of information on Russian oil and gas. I would definitely recommend it to listeners to check out this report, but also their work in general. And they published a fascinating technical note on this, which discusses the legal difference between transshipment and re-export. And they noted that while the former, transshipment, is banned in some circumstances, the latter isn't. Re-export would in general be hard to enforce. So those working in the LNG import-export trade are clearly navigating a hell of a lot of complexity and a lot of legal nuance here, but ultimately the facts don't lie, and European imports of Russian LNG have been rising, not falling. And in fact, as I said, more than half of Russia's LNG production went to Europe last year. So something isn't working. I was in Brussels a few weeks ago, and there was lots of discussion around this. The Parliament want the European Council, so that's the member states, to act. Sanctions is a member state prerogative, so it's all about what the European Council do. European Parliament has passed a couple of motions on this already, but the member states are reluctant to move on it, and in terms of the balance of power, as it were, on the European Council, I think there's a concern that a move against LNG could lead to a new energy crisis. So that's broadly where we're at the moment.
Wow, that's really interesting. And I want to ask, according to your observations, how prepared is Russia to retool and restructure its economy in order to align with these global efforts towards net zero emissions?
Well, sanctions doesn't help. I mean, sanctions is cutting off the supply of capital investment needed to make that transition. And so Russian economy has been mobilizing enormous amounts of state-backed investment for the military industrial complex and has been paying for that through the use of oil and gas rents. Now, of course, the rational thing for Russia to be doing right now is to be investing in the industries and infrastructure of the future. It wouldn't be to wasting extraordinary amounts of money and life, you know, the Russian workers losing their life or coming back with disabilities. I mean, this is all a blow to the productive capacity of the Russian economy. Now, I think where I would hesitate slightly, and, you know, I'm based in London. We do a lot of research on the ground in Ukraine. We don't have the same granular insight into what's happening in Russia, much more dependent on secondary sources and so on and so forth. So I hesitate to answer particularly categorically on this. But of course, if you're the Russian regime, you must be looking at LNG as a growth area. But the amounts of money that you're mobilizing on the war effort are not helpful to making that transition. So I think sometimes in wider discourses, there's this idea that military Keynesianism is good for the Russian economy, there's an element of truth in that picture to a degree, but only because Russia had an extremely fiscally conservative approach to its economy prior to the full-scale invasion. And by mobilizing massive amounts of money at soldiers' salaries and other subsidy schemes, it's addressed a problem of underconsumption that existed in the economy. But that doesn't amount to investing productively in the industries that Russia needs to advance in the future. And the war certainly doesn't help that by any stretch whatsoever. It makes it much harder to do. It's taking money out of the productive civilian economy and putting it in unproductive military consumption at the end of the day.
I'm glad you mentioned the civilian economy, and I'm sure we will speak more on this. But when we take into account the people on the ground, the very basic building block of any economy is its human capital. And in your paper, you highlight the challenges that both Russia and Ukraine currently face in terms of mobilizing this human capital towards the war effort. However, as you point out, these challenges are very different. So could you tell us more about that?
Yeah, so the critical resource that is being mobilized, of course, is labor, and it's troops for the front line, and those troops need to be like looked after, they need to be clothed, they need to be fed, they need to be paid decent salaries. Of course, in the future, their pensions will need to be paid, etc., too. So this is a major mobilization of resources, and both sides have paid their frontline soldiers significantly higher wages than the national average in order to incentivize the enormous risks they're taking with their own lives to support their country's war efforts. This is probably one of the most important features of military Keynesianism across the two sides, actually, because those soldiers have been sending those wages home to their families, to their friends, perhaps. They've been injecting that demand into the economy by spending those wages on basic goods, on perhaps in the case, in some cases in Russia, you have these enormous signing on fees for particular regions, not all of them. But in some regions, it's enough to buy a flat outright, never mind worry about a mortgage. You could just literally buy a flat. So this is a serious injection of cash into working class communities. And of course, that costs money, and both sides have had to mobilize it. I think that in some ways, the war economies are similar on that level. Financial incentives are relied upon heavily to mobilize soldiers to the front line, but also in the sense that both sides have stopped short of a full centralization of labor and the economy of the type we would associate with a system of command planning. So the example of this on the Ukrainian side that I like to talk about is the steel facility that I visited in Dnipro last October. That's about 100 kilometers from the front line. But the steel pipes and railway train wheels that were being produced at the factory, they weren't supporting the war effort. The steel facility hadn't been taken over by the armed forces in any respect. It was a very high-tech facility, but they were exporting to the European market. And of course, indirectly supporting the war effort through the payment of taxation, etc., by maintaining that kind of civilian economy as functional. So this is where the concept of military Keynesianism is helpful in a way, because it's not referring to a situation of full economic centralization. It's referring to a mixed economy where there's elements of economic centralization and war-supported demand, which fundamentally reshape the rest of the economy, but do so indirectly. So it's not a case of the state taking the whole thing over. And that, of course, I think is significant in terms of this everyday life component as well. So, you know, to some extent, there is, in quote marks, elements of normality and civilian economic relationships that are continuing to operate within these otherwise war-dominated contexts. So that mix, I think that hybridity seems to be really important to analysing both of the sides and how they're mobilising resources for the war.
And coming back to domestic concerns for Russia, you write that a country of over 140 million may be headed for a credit crunch. What do you mean by that?
Yes, so there's two sources of potential financial instability in the Russian economy. The first is the subsidized credit injections that the Russian regime has put into the military-industrial complex. And this has taken the form of corporate bonds. We know about this now thanks to a really important, interesting, super interesting report from Craig Kennedy of a couple of months ago now that highlighted how Russia had essentially built a shadow banking system where companies in the military-industrial complex had been issuing bonds to state-owned enterprises, to Russian banks, that were purchasing those bonds at subsidized prices. So it's an injection of cheap credit into the economy. And this is really critical to sort of unlocking part of the mystery of the Russian war economy up until now. And part of that mystery has been, where has the money been coming from? Because it appears to be that Russia was spending far more on its military industrial complex than you would imagine from its government spending. And to answer that mystery, we can look at that shadow banking system. And the question is whether in the future, some of those enterprises that have accumulated these very large debts will be good for the money, and whether they will become non-performing for the state-owned banks. And if they do become non-performing for the state-owned banks, what kind of fitness are they in to deal with that? The second source of financial instability for the Russian economy is distinctive. And so if we imagine the Russian economy really as a like dualistic structure now, you have this military-industrial complex where firms in it get access to subsidized credits. At the same time, you have a civilian economy where the enterprises within the civilian economy don't have access to that cheap subsidized credit. And the Russian Central Bank has been looking at the economy and saying, well, look, there's been this massive expansion of the monetary supply that has created lots of money circulating around in the economy that's created fundamental inflationary pressures. And so to deal with that, we need to try to restrict the monetary supply in the economy by raising interest rates extremely sharply. And they've been running for some time now, and a basic rate of 21%. And if you, in relation to Russia's official inflation rate, that's really quite exceptionally high. I mean, it was, by as one analyst described it, David Lubin at Chatham House, the world's tightest monetary policy. You can check this out yourself if you go to a Russian mortgage calculator website and put in a few details and see what kind of mortgage you're offered at, say, this deposit with this wage and that kind of thing. You get exceptionally high interest rates coming back at you, like 30% commercial rates. So of course, for any consumer will know who's going to really borrow at 30% interest rates. Now, the Russian state was offering subsidized debt and mortgages to the commercial economy until last summer, but has now withdrawn those programs. And so with consumer and business credit falling, because consumers and businesses don't want to borrow at those exceptionally high interest rates, and with this other shadow banking system operating, and within the context of the entire economy being built on the edifice of oil and gas rents, then the critical source of financial instability at the end of the day is this falling oil price. And so with oil trending downwards, it's possible that Russia could experience a credit crunch that's similar to the one it experienced at the last significant fall and sustained fall in oil prices in 2014 and 2015. It's quite possible that there would need to be some kind of central government intervention to support the banking system in that context, which would be a reminder of the difficult distributional trade-offs that the war will increasingly pose for the Russian regime.
Okay, and we've spoken at length about Russia's tendency to rely on oil rents to subsidize its economy. But what about Ukraine? You highlight quite a clear-cut dependency on foreign aid and grants. And the official statistic from the Ukrainian government states that 46% of its budget expenditure was covered by foreign aid in 2023, including from the EU, the US, and the IMF. To keep spending, including on military defense, Ukraine needs its allies. You do reference in your paper the prospect of US halting aid, which I'm curious to ask about. Is this lifeline under threat? Does a cut in US support mark doomsday?
No, it doesn't mark a doomsday, but there will need to be more money raised from European allies, and there's a discussion around that at the moment. So Ukraine has planned its government spending from 2025 to 2027. In principle, it's used non-American sources of financial aid. So these are institutions, so the IMF, World Bank, European Union, and national governments, Ukraine's allies, that have either directly or indirectly through those institutions be paying into the Ukrainian budget. And it's designed that influx of aid, and it had already done this prior to the American presidential election, assuming that there would be no further American financial support. At the same time, the Biden administration did Ukraine and the world a great favor during the transitional period, so the period between Harris losing the election to Trump and Biden leaving office. And he transferred $20 billion, $15 billion in direct aid, and $5 billion in concessional loans to a World Bank program. That was based on profits from Russian sanctioned assets that are now being utilized to support the Ukrainian war economy and to fund ongoing reconstruction needs. So Ukraine, as you say in the report, I do argue that both the Ukrainian and Russian sides should be understood as externally dependent, but in different forms. So in the Russian case, the external dependency is on oil and gas rents. In the Ukrainian case, the external dependency comes from that dependency on foreign aid from allies. Now, a year ago, if I had said, oh, it's dependency and that kind of thing, maybe someone would have said, well, you know, it's not dependency, it's not a power relation, this is aid provided on the grounds of mutual interest and in support of collective security. And of course, I would say that's completely true, but no one anticipated, perhaps, or maybe we should have done, quite how radical the Trump administration would go over the last 3 months in directly trying to leverage its power over Ukraine to gain access to Ukraine's critical infrastructure and raw materials in this nakedly colonial fashion. And of course, the fact that the Trump administration has done that is an illustration of some of the risks that Ukraine faces in general when its war economy is so dependent on external support. And political polarization is happening all over the world. The far right are growing all over the world. There's a problem of authoritarianism, etc., everywhere. So, of course, this is an ongoing risk and challenge for the Ukrainian side. The fact that it needs to raise revenue internationally from its allies to maintain not only its war economy, but its basic underpinning civilian infrastructure too.
And for now, that concludes today's episode on the political economy of the war in Ukraine. This series of Conflict Zone is produced by PeaceRep, an international research project exploring the changing nature of conflict, peace, and transition processes in the contemporary world. PeaceRep is funded by the UK Foreign, Commonwealth and Development Office. The information set out in this podcast are those of our experts, and nothing herein constitutes the views of the FCDO. We hope you found it informative and educational. You can always find out more on the Conflict and Civicness Research Group page of the LSE website. There you'll also find our details on upcoming events, videos of previous ones, and links to all our publications. Please do follow us on X at LSCCCRG, and we hope to see you next time.